The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Protesters in Myanmar are taking to the streets, angry about military rule. The military is cracking down, but the protesters have an ally on Pennsylvania Avenue.
As protests grow, violence against those asserting their democratic rights is unacceptable, and we're going to keep calling it out.
Also today, many Afghans escaped war by crossing the border into Iran. Then they had to flee again back to Afghanistan.
A lot of people were simply worried about the health consequences of COVID-19. Also, they're having more challenges finding work.
Also, coming up on the show... Does that make you happy or does it make you twitch? I'm Marco Werman. We'll explain what that is and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you today. The military in Myanmar is now firmly in charge. A week and a half ago, the army ousted elected leaders. Much of the public is not happy about that. People across Myanmar have been taking part in large protests. The police and military are cracking down. Security forces are using water cannons to break up the crowds. They've also fired live ammunition. President Joe Biden is weighing in, throwing U.S. support behind the protesters.
As protests grow, violence against those asserting their democratic rights is unacceptable, and we're going to keep calling it out. The people of Burma are making their voices heard, and the world is watching.
Burma, the former name of Myanmar. Biden also announced that the U.S. will punish Myanmar's military by freezing some of the country's assets. The World's Patrick Wynn has been following the story. What exactly did the White House do here, Patrick?
Well, basically, Marco, it's freezing some of the Myanmar government's money so that the generals who plotted the coup can't spend it. The White House wasn't totally explicit, but what seems to be happening is this. So Myanmar, like most countries in the world, keeps a ton of money in the United States in the Federal Reserve. That's the best place to store dollars, which, you know, is the world's dominant currency. So the Federal Reserve is seen as a safe, secure place to keep that money until you stage a coup and the U.S. gets angry at you because now that money is frozen, the generals who pulled off the coup can't touch it, and presumably the U.S. will give it back when the generals restore democracy, because it does belong to the government and not the military per se.
Could this be a game changer?
No, I don't think so, because it's just $1 billion, and these generals can get by without it. Nor is it the only sanctions they face. I mean, the coup leader, General Min Aung Hlaing, for example, he's already under sanctions for overseeing ethnic cleansing of the indigenous Rohingya people in Myanmar. So he and certain leaders, they already can't visit the U.S., and they already can't do business with Americans, but they don't need to because most foreign investment in Myanmar comes from China. China's right next door to Myanmar, and that can keep the country afloat even if the West pulls away. And just to be clear, Marco, you know, the military generals are not puppets of Beijing. These guys are really hardcore nationalists, and they are afraid of Chinese domination. It's just that they find China much easier to deal with than the West, which is often condemning their behavior.
So is there anything more the U.S. can do?
Yeah, there are a few things. I mean, the White House has said this is ongoing. They're continuing to roll out new punishments. After Joe Biden's announcement about the $1 billion, he issued an executive order that appears to go after the business interest of just about anyone involved in the coup, high-level military, their families, and their kids. But again, these military guys and their cronies don't really rely on doing business in the West anyway. And then beyond that, Marco, Joe Biden starts to run out of options. I mean, he could do what the U.S. does to Venezuela and Iran and just do crushing sanctions. That is what the U.S. used to do to Myanmar until Barack Obama came along. It just treated Myanmar as this place where, and I'm going to quote a former ambassador, where the U.S. could, quote, enjoy the luxury of our ideals, just go super hard on the regime, push for human rights in a way that you couldn't do on a country that you really depend on, like Saudi Arabia. But as you can see, the heavy sanctions didn't just fix the country the first time. It would be even more unbearable if they did that under COVID. And it may be that the U.S. doesn't have that much influence over what happens next.
Well, I was going to ask, like, what can you tell us about the generals who are in charge? Is there one person or is it a council? Who is Washington supposed to be talking to there? Or is it going to return to a hermit state like it was for many years?
Well, Washington would like to talk to Aung San Suu Kyi, who should be the rightfully elected, they call it state counselor, the political leader. They have not been able to get through to her. So who's in charge? That would be General Min Aung Hlaing and his inner circle. These are the guys that run the military. They are a notoriously vicious group. I mean, they have gone after indigenous people in Myanmar, not just the Rohingya, but many other ethnicities. They have been involved in undermining democracy for years and years and years. They're old hands at this.
Finally, what does this mean for the Rohingya who are languishing in refugee camps like Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh? How does the coup recast their future?
Well, they weren't allowed to vote in the first place. I've talked to Rohingya who stay in touch with people in the camps, and they say mostly this coup doesn't really affect their lives that much. What it does affect is the future. So if they want to imagine a future in which elected leaders are convinced that the Rohingya should get full human rights and want to change things, then that is a possibility as long as there's democracy, as long as there's elections. But as long as the military is in full totalitarian control, they have zero hope of things changing because the military, you know, going back decades, has never treated the Rohingya fairly.
The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen with the latest on the new military regime in Myanmar that arrived just last week. Patrick, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Marco.
In December, you'll recall, there was that massive cyber attack against several federal agencies, the so-called SolarWinds hack. Lawmakers and intelligence officials are still trying to fully understand the scope and impact of what happened. What became clear from security experts at a congressional hearing this week, the U.S. is not doing enough to limit risks and deter adversaries in cyberspace. Here's the world's Lydia Emanuelidou with the latest.
This sophisticated hack began with SolarWinds, a Texas-based company that makes software used by a slew of private firms and government agencies. Hackers found a vulnerability in SolarWinds code. They exploited it to infiltrate the networks of several U.S. government agencies and potentially thousands of companies around the world. They're believed to be working for the Russian government.
So I actually believe SolarWinds really represents a new normal for Russian intelligence.
Cybersecurity expert Dmitry Alperovich was one of the people testifying about the hack before the House Homeland Security Committee yesterday. He said Russia-linked hackers have entered U.S. systems in the past, but they were detected very quickly. Now it appears they figured out how to gain long-term access into networks, watching undetected.
In some ways, this mirrors exactly what they're doing in human intelligence.
You know, like traditional spying, implanting in a society for years, decades, and trying to get close to people in power to steal secrets. Although we don't know for sure what the SolarWinds hackers were after, many believe the point of the intrusion was espionage.
I think this is going to continue on for many years to come. And China, I'm sure, is looking at this very carefully and trying to adopt the same practices.
The U.S. is facing increasingly sophisticated threats from other foreign adversaries, too, like Iran and North Korea, according to testimony from Chris Krebs. He used to head cybersecurity at DHS, but was fired by President Trump in November after challenging Trump's false claims of widespread fraud in the 2020 election. Krebs has since founded a private company that's advising SolarWinds on the hack. He said right now the U.S. is in a perilous position.
We have to change the way we act.
Right now, more than 100 different government agencies are basically making decisions on their own about how to secure their networks. He also wants to see stricter standards for private companies that work with federal agencies, like requiring annual audits of their source code.
I also hope that the private sector now has had its awakening.
Krebs and other experts said the private and public sectors also need to be working more closely with one another, sharing intelligence and information. And they need to be synchronized and ready to play defense together when needed. Sue Gordon used to be the second highest ranking official at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. She says the U.S. also needs to set clearer boundaries to deter adversaries.
If those lines are crossed, we will respond.
Though it's not always clear how to respond. Sanctions, naming and shaming haven't worked so well in the past. Those testifying insisted the U.S. could work with allies to put pressure on governments behind big hacks, but they warned the U.S. also has a long history of similar cyber attacks against its adversaries. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Today marks day three of the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump. House managers completed their arguments. Democratic Congresswoman Diana DeGette of Colorado looked back at the January 6 attack on the Capitol through the eyes of the insurrectionists and concluded this.
Their own statements before, during, and after the attack make clear the attack was done for Donald Trump, at his instructions, and to fulfill his wishes.
This week, the jury, the U.S. Senate, has been shown violent video footage that clearly illustrates just how close a mob came to physically assaulting lawmakers on January 6. That appears to have shaken some elected officials who'd been unaware of the level of danger that day. Others say they're ready to move on. Our next guest cautions against putting it all behind us just yet. Kelebohile Jirogbo is a political scientist who studies truth commissions at the College of William and Mary. She says efforts like truth commissions are necessary, even though there's never an easy time to create them.
The truth, when unaddressed, is always going to be uncomfortable. Think about Guatemala having a truth commission in 1999 in the aftermath of a decades-long internal armed conflict during which genocide was perpetrated, right? I think of similar things in Rwanda. I think of South Africa, where there was some of the most severe racial violence the world has ever seen. And yet, transitional justice was core to moving the country forward, core to legitimizing the new governments in these different countries, that they would be governments that would operate under the rule of law, that people would not be above the law, that the society would not be beyond accountability. That is essential in the U.S.
Kelly, exactly what types of transitional institutions do you think the U.S. could benefit from?
So a lot of people don't know, but the U.S. has actually had truth commissions before at the city, the state, and the national level. So the first U.S. truth commission and the only one with a national scope and national ambition was in the early 80s.
What was that commission looking into?
Yes, this commission studied the relocation and internment of persons of Japanese ancestry during the Second World War. Mm. It was the fruit of grassroots mobilization and also a fair amount of lobbying lawmakers in Congress.
So new leaders, and this is Biden's case, they often face the question of how to deal with their predecessors' potential lawbreaking. President Barack Obama was asked in 2009 if he would investigate alleged crimes of the Bush administration, including torture. Here's what he had to say.
I don't believe that anybody is above the law. On the other hand, I also have a belief that we need to look forward as opposed to looking backwards.
So Obama's White House, Kelly, did not revisit the potential crimes by the Bush administration. Obama tried to walk a fine line, saying, while no one is above the law, investigations can get into the way of unity and healing. Does he have a point?
That's really the approach of most U.S. administrations going as far back as the Reconstruction period, right? Like, let's move forward, let's move forward. But you look at the status quo today, you look at our current politics, and there's at least an indication that moving forward without at least taking some time to pause, look back, may not necessarily have been the most effective one. Now, I think one concern that I think is a legitimate concern is the issue of victor's justice, right? This is something that is addressed pretty extensively in international relations, dating back to the Nuremberg tribunals and the Tokyo tribunals, right? You have the allied powers essentially meting out justice for their now vanquished enemies. And so I think there is a concern of a type of victor's justice.
So we spoke with historian Anne Applebaum earlier this week about societal reckonings. And she argued that it's time for those who oppose Trump to change the subject and work on shared projects with conservatives instead of focusing on divisions. Our shared endeavors, I don't know, like infrastructure projects, railroads, or a national renewable energy initiative, is that a way to build a foundation to move forward?
I think those are things that are certainly worth pursuing, but I would actually caution against that. And I would say we should, you know, really chasten ourselves and kind of brace ourselves to deal with the truth of the past. Otherwise, there will be more and worse ahead.
Kelebohile Jirogbo is a political scientist who studies truth commissions at the College of William and Mary. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I worked on a farm in France one summer in college, and every day at lunch, the boss would pay for lunch for his farmhands at the local bistro, a French meal with wine, and then back to work. I just recently learned, though, that in France, it's actually illegal to eat lunch at your desk. Yep, there's a law, but now with the coronavirus, that has changed. The government has temporarily relaxed that rule. We asked the world's Sarah Birnbaum to investigate if this is the beginning of the end for the sacred French lunch.
Ian Moore moved to France from the UK 16 years ago, and he says he remembers the exact moment he truly understood what lunchtime means to the French.
My local airport is a very small airport in the Loire Valley. It's called Tours. And I was flying out of Tours Airport, and I tried to log onto the Wi-Fi, and their message on the screen said the Wi-Fi was shut for lunch. So even the Wi-Fi shuts down. I don't know what they eat. I don't know what Wi-Fi eats, but it was even the Wi-Fi was shut down for lunch.
He says basically everything shuts down between 12 and 2. Stores close. Doctor's offices close. No one answers the phone. The French labor code forbids workers from eating at their desks, and employers can get fined for it. Contrast that with the U.S., 65% of us say we eat at our desks or don't take lunch breaks at all. It's like a mark of our toughness, like Michael Douglas says in the movie Wall Street.
Lunch? Oh, you gotta be kidding. Lunch is for wimps.
My former colleague, Adeline Cyr, grew up in France. She says when she moved to the U.S., it was a culture shock.
When I came to the United States, it was over 20 years ago, I felt like eating a sandwich was an act of desperation, because why would you want to eat at your desk when you could just sit down and have a meal? That was just completely incomprehensible to me.
Adeline called her sister back in France and told her that everyone in the office was eating in 5 minutes or less.
She was horrified, horrified. And she said to me, no one, no boss will make me eat at my desk.
Adeline says her sister has come around a bit because things in France, like in the rest of the world, have been changing even before COVID. The three-course lunch with wine and cheese is giving way to sandwiches and fast food. Companies are offering shorter lunch breaks. And those millennials and Gen Zers like eating alone.
But there's still very much the sense that you need to take that break. It's important. It's part of the culture.
COVID-19 has had a way of messing with our rituals and our cultural experiences. The French government relaxed the no eating at your desk rule because restaurants are closed and work cafeterias are super spreader sites. But Ian Moore, for one, doesn't think the change will be permanent. He says the French just won't stand for it.
There was a joke in France last year when everybody was in confinement and you couldn't go out and do anything. The joke was, what are the French up to? Well, they're striking from home these days. That's how we're doing things.
In other words, he says, the message is, you can impose curfews, you can make us wear masks, but you will never take away our national character. And lunchtime is a big part of that. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Albert Einstein, Enrico Fermi, Robert Oppenheimer. Chances are you know the names of these famous physicists. Today, a new U.S. postage stamp has been issued honoring one of their peers who is often overlooked. Xian Shangwu was a groundbreaking Chinese-American scientist known by many as the First Lady of Physics. Joining us now to talk about her life is Wu's granddaughter, Jada Yuan. She's also a journalist at The Washington Post. What does it feel like for you today, Jada, to see your grandmother's likeness on a new stamp?
We had a virtual ceremony that the post office put together that my father, Vincent Yuan, and myself and some of my grandmother's old students participated in. And it was just, it's just been really great just hearing well wishes from everyone, and that some of my friends watched it and cried. A lot of them have felt, I think, very uplifted about this story of a woman with great accomplishments being recognized after the fact for some of the accomplishments she didn't get recognized for in her lifetime.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, your grandmother helped develop a fundamental law of physics. She made key contributions to the Manhattan Project. Many say she was unfairly overlooked for the Nobel Prize because of her gender. When you were growing up, did you know how important she was in the scientific community?
Not at all. She was really modest and she didn't talk about her scientific life that much to me. And I didn't know she was famous really until her funeral, when I showed up and there were a bunch of cameras from Chinese television stations. And I've had a lot of time to reflect over the past 3 months or so that since we found out that the stamp was really going to happen, about how my grandmother influenced me. And I think that a lot of it was just being around someone who just had no doubt in her abilities and no doubt in the idea that women and girls had the same abilities as men should have, but they were simply not given the same opportunities.
What can you tell us about her childhood and how she came to work as a scientist in the U.S.?
She was born in 1912 in a river town outside of Shanghai. And her father, who she was incredibly reverent of, founded a school and then invited families to send girls to school, which was really not done at the time. It only went up to elementary school. And then at age 11, she had to move on to a boarding school 50 miles from her family. And then she had to go to university. And so she was away from her family, basically, since she was 11. And then finally, she went to the U.S. when she was 24. And pretty soon afterwards, war broke out between the Chinese and Japanese, and then World War II broke out, and then the Cultural Revolution happened in China, and it was just impossible for her to come back. Her parents died, and she never saw them again after she left. So just to think of that kind of perseverance in search of an education, in search of knowledge, and wanting to contribute to our understanding of the universe, I think it's pretty profound.
In the lead up to today, people have been sharing how Wu inspired them to get into science and memories of her. Do you have any memories of your grandmother that are coming to mind today?
She and my grandfather had these two yellow corduroy armchairs that they used to sit in by their window. And they had a nice Columbia University apartment that looked out over Barnard College, which was next door. And we would just sit there and we would watch the girls' basketball team through the window. And she was always just really proud of their athletic achievements. And that was something that my dad was talking to me about, was that she really admired achievement in every field, and especially like women achieving in fields where it was really difficult. She had this quiet respect for integrity and for hard work and determination. And that's what I remember the most.
Jada Yuan is a political feature writer for the Washington Post Style section. She also happens to be the granddaughter of groundbreaking nuclear physicist Xian Shengwu, who was honored today with a new U.S. Forever stamp. Jada, thanks for telling us about your grandmother.
Thank you so much for having me.
The news can be a fast-moving target, but when you've got the world's morning newsletter in your email inbox, we make the target easier to find. Follow the news we're watching each morning by signing up for our newsletter. Just head over to theworld.org/newsletters. Marco Werman here. 1,098. That's how many people donated to The World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 1,098 incredible people, maybe you're one of them, helped us surpass our goal of $100,000. And we want to thank some of you right now. Deanne Farrar, Rob Hayes, Don Pugh, Manny and Mayer, Camila Ziadine, Sinduja Srinivasan, Darren Croft, Polly and Anderson Tice, Roshni Kotari, and Morgan Fitzpatrick Andrews. Also, thank you to not only the 1,098, but to all of our listeners. We could not have done it without you. China's new gambit to halt climate change put a price tag on pollution. It won't change things immediately, but Beijing now has a tool to get things moving.
And any day they want to make it more effective and efficient, it can be done overnight.
Also, Korean a cappella decides to pick up the phone. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. What do you do when your place of refuge is no longer safe? That's a question thousands of Afghan migrants have been facing ever since last spring, when Iran became one of the epicenters of the coronavirus pandemic. Iran has long been a destination for Afghans in search of relative safety as well as job opportunities. But as The World's Shirin Jafari reports, the pandemic as well as Iran's economic downturn have forced thousands of migrants to return to Afghanistan or come up with a plan B.
Last summer, As the coronavirus pandemic was ravaging cities across Iran, 30-year-old Mohammad Parviz Amini was in despair. Amini is from Afghanistan, but he had relocated to Iran to find work. What he found instead, he says, was a country unable to contain a deadly virus. Iran's economy was buckling under U.S. sanctions, and the public was generally not welcoming of Afghans. No way Amini was going back to Afghanistan, he tells me. Logar province, where he and his family of five are from, is mostly under Taliban rule, and there's fighting almost every day. If you stay there, he says, you'll end up dead. Left with no choice, Amini and his wife decided to pay a smuggler to get out of Iran and go to Turkey. They scraped together about $7,000, basically their life savings, he says, and they found a smuggler. They were on the move again. They got to the Turkish border at about 3 in the morning, Amini says. The smuggler vanished with the money, and then the Turkish border guards arrested them. They confiscated our belongings, he says, and set them on fire right in front of us. The next day, the family was handed over to Iranian authorities. In the next few weeks, they were moved through different holding centers in Iran and eventually deported back to Afghanistan. I reach Amini shortly after he arrives with his family in Herat, a city in northwest Afghanistan, near the border with Iran. We speak over WhatsApp, and he sounds tired from the long days on the road. He's at a center for migrants and refugees run by the International Organization for Migration. Aziz Rahimi has been working for the IOM for the past 20 years. Last year, he says, almost 1 million undocumented Afghans returned home. That's roughly double the previous year. Most were deported, but some came back voluntarily because they couldn't find work or they were worried about getting the coronavirus. Before the pandemic, Iran was a lifeline for Afghans looking for work, says Nicholas Bishop, an emergency response officer at IOM. He says Afghan families have been sending their young men to work in construction, farms and factories in Iran for years.
Remittance payments from Afghans working in Iran is typically a major part of the Afghan economy.
Bishop says these remittances could account for as much as 15% to 20% of Afghanistan's GDP. But the pandemic turned everything upside down, he says. Afghans working in Iran lost their jobs. Meanwhile, the Trump administration imposed some of the most severe economic sanctions on Iran, further choking its economy. Hossein Ali worked at a glass factory near Tehran, the capital. He says the factory closed down for a few months because of the pandemic. But that's not why he's back in Afghanistan. He was deported after police found out he doesn't have the right documents. He says the police beat him and sent him back across the border. These sorts of claims are common, says Fatemeh Aman. She's with the Middle East Institute in Washington.
People without proper paper and documents are the most defenseless in Iran.
Aman has done research on Afghans in Iran. She says last May, a group of migrants drowned in a river near the border. Witnesses said the migrants were forced into the water by Iranian border guards. Aman says even those with the right papers face discrimination. Their access to healthcare and education is limited. They can't get citizenship, and most of them can't buy or sell property. The spokesperson for Afghanistan's Ministry for Refugee Affairs tells me discussions between the two governments are ongoing. Sayyid Abdul Basit Ansari says after the drowning incident, the Afghan government sent a delegation to Tehran. The two sides have agreed to issue electronic IDs for all Afghan migrants in Iran. Still, many continue to be deported, and they face insecurity, unemployment, and poverty back home. Muhammad Amini, the man who used to live in Taliban territory, says he doesn't know what to do next. He doesn't want to take his family back to Logar province, and he doesn't know where to find work. Nicholas Bishop of the IOM says the situation for families like Amini's could get even worse. That's because there's been so little rain and snow in parts of the country.
Afghanistan's agriculture is heavily dependent on rain-fed agriculture and snowmelt. So the humanitarian response plan for this year is suggesting that as many as 17 million Afghans, or about 42% of the total population, will be impacted by drought and famine.
The peace talks with the Taliban have stalled. Violence across the country is on the rise, and now there's a possible drought on the way. It's no wonder that Afghans like Amini say they will try to leave once again. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
President Biden had his first official phone call with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. The two leaders spoke last night about areas for greater cooperation. According to the White House, Biden also underscored concerns about Beijing's unfair economic practices, the crackdown in Hong Kong, and human rights abuses in Xinjiang in northwest China. Jessica Chen Weiss follows Chinese foreign policy at Cornell University, where she's a political scientist. Jessica, it's a paragraph from the White House explaining what was said between the two leaders. What are your takeaways from what we know about Biden's phone call with Xi, both what was said and what wasn't said?
Thanks. Well, I think there's a big difference between a paragraph readout and a two-hour phone call. So there's a lot there that we're not seeing. I think that probably reflects the fact that publicly, the Biden administration has a lot of incentive to sound tough on Xi Jinping and his increasingly authoritarian form of governance at home. But, you know, he also wants to make sure that he preserves space to both work pragmatically with China on issues like climate change and getting the pandemic under control, and also ensure that his nominees and his domestic agenda move through Congress. So I think you see in both Beijing and in Washington a desire for of a more stable relationship after the escalation under the Trump administration. And that's for a couple of reasons. China sees the United States as posing an ideological challenge. The Chinese regime is ideologically insecure, but the United States needs to be careful not to out-China China in inflating the threat that these ideological differences pose. And I think that designing U.S. strategy around grand strategy to save democracy and fight authoritarianism could backfire.
So how does that delicate dance work? How can the U.S. both call out China on human rights violations while also cooperating on climate or trade?
Well, the best hope is that these can be pursued independently. The United States can work to uphold its values and defend democracy while on a separate track, working with China and others to tackle shared challenges. That might be tough because the Chinese are not interested in, on the one hand, being beat up over accusations of genocide in Xinjiang, while at the same time working hand in hand to combat climate change. Even in the readout of the Biden-Xi phone call on the U.S. side, the fact that it was human rights abuses that Biden called out in Xinjiang rather than using that term genocide may be a pragmatic recognition that when dealing with China directly, it's important to get the messaging right such that the Chinese side has some reason to remain at the table rather than walking away.
It was the State Department under Mike Pompeo that labeled what's happening in Xinjiang genocide. Is Biden still hewing to that word and just did not use it, or what's going on?
Well, you know, Secretary of State Blinken similarly used that term, in his confirmation hearing. And my understanding is that the State Department is reviewing that designation and determining what to do going forward.
So let's look at a couple of specific areas where you think U.S.-China cooperation is most crucial, starting with climate. Both countries are big carbon emitters. Both are pledging big commitments. How can China and the U.S. cooperate on carbon reduction, do you think?
Well, there's a bilateral component as well as a multilateral component. Many have pointed out that both the United States and China have a shared national interest in reducing carbon emissions. But the real challenge will also be bringing other countries along. In that sense, U.S.-China cooperation is indispensable, not just at coordinating bilateral efforts, but also in getting more countries to move quickly in this direction, as there's no time to lose.
And on trade, the Trump administration, of course, was tough on China and used trade as a way to punish it for misbehavior. What's the Biden administration going to do that will be different and suggest there's a change in its trading posture with China? Because as of now, Biden is leaving those Trump tariffs in place, right?
Well, the first thing is that the Biden administration is planning clearly a much more multilateral approach rather than imposing tariffs on allies and then going it alone vis-a-vis China. But even there will be a lot to work out. On the one hand, a desire to promote American industry, to buy American, but there also a desire to work with partners and allies in forging a joint approach to China. So I think there, too, the Biden administration has signaled that it wants to take a look at everything that the Trump administration left behind, work with allies and partners on what a more coordinated approach might look like. And so that's going to take a little bit of time before we see changes in the leftover tariffs.
Cornell University political scientist Jessica Chen Weiss speaking with us about U.S.-China relations under the Biden administration. Jessica, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
This month, China took a big, long-awaited step to try and curb the spread of greenhouse gases that fuel climate change. Beijing launched what's called a carbon market, basically a way for power plants to trade emissions credits. Think of it this way. If power plant A is running extra clean, it can sell some of its credits to power plant B that's running a little dirtier. The idea is to give a monetary incentive to lower emissions. That's what we're looking at today on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
So how much can China's new carbon market help fight climate change? The world's Anna Kussmer took a dive into that and has this report.
A carbon market generally means that every molecule of carbon that leaves a smokestack has a tiny price tag on it. They have a pretty singular goal, says carbon market expert Yan Qin.
Carbon market is a market-based mechanism. It's aiming to reduce emissions, reduce carbon emissions.
In most countries with carbon markets, the government sets a cap on carbon emissions for, say, the power industry or manufacturing, and then companies can buy or trade credits, but altogether they have to stay under an emissions limit. China's market is different. There's no cap. The focus is on the efficiency of power plants.
The priority is that to improve the overall efficiency of the coal fleet to make the overall emission factor to decline.
As of this month, China's carbon market covers some 2,000 power plants in China, mostly coal. Inefficient coal-fired power plants now have to buy credits. Efficient plants have credits to sell. It's a baby step, not likely to be closing down coal plants in the near future.
China seems to be starting very softly with not very strict targets.
China is still building and planning new coal-fired power plants. Whether the carbon market can interrupt that trajectory will depend on whether that first baby step turns into something more.
二氧化碳排放力争于2030年前
President Xi Jinping announced in September that the country will reach peak emissions by 2030 and net zero emissions by 2060. To get there, coal, a historic engine of China's economic growth, needs to be phased out. As the rules are now, the new carbon market won't shrink the coal industry. But if the rules change, it could, says Yvonne Liu, a China energy expert with Bloomberg.
I believe China will gradually tighten up the rules.
Like raising the price of carbon or limiting the total amount of emissions rather than just focusing on efficiency.
We will definitely keep on watching how fast and how tight China can change the rules. So now the Chinese government has a tool, and any day they want to make it more effective and efficient, it can be done overnight.
Other carbon markets, like the one in the European Union, also rolled out slowly and were eventually made restrictive enough to reduce emissions. That's something Li Shuo with Greenpeace China hopes will happen in his country.
It diversifies the tools that the government can use.
He said there are indications that China wants to make big moves to clean up its power sector. Just this week, the government announced it's considering boosting renewables to cover 40% of the country's electricity by 2030.
The country realizes, right, it needs to accelerate in moving away from coal.
There's increasing international pressure to do that. Here's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking to Chinese university students last summer.
There is no such thing as clean coal.
and coal should have no place in any rational recovery plan.
There's also the question of whether the market could help with the transition to renewables. Li Shuo with Greenpeace says a higher price on carbon would also make renewable energy more financially attractive.
I mean, I have no doubt that the speed and the momentum that we have seen over the past decade with regard to wind and solar development will continue. The only question is, can we do it even faster? That's the only question.
Li says the carbon market could be used to speed up that process. China's carbon market currently covers power plants that account for 15% of the world's carbon emissions. Government officials say they plan to expand the market in the next 5 years to cover around 80% of China's CO2 emissions. That's a fifth of the world's.
Whatever the Chinese government decides to do in terms of its interventions into environmental protection can have overnight very significant impact on the planet.
Yifei Li is an environmental policy expert at NYU Shanghai. He says the sheer scale of China's carbon market and the power of its government is a double-edged sword. The market could be used to surveil and control members of industry in ways that are harmful or unfair. And there's the issue of transparency.
China doesn't have a stellar track record of being transparent with its own data. So overall, I think, you know, the idea of a carbon market can only work if there is a robust monitoring, reporting, and verification system.
Next month, China will release its next five-year plan, and that will likely provide information about the role the carbon market will play in reaching the country's big net zero goal. For the World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
She'd done nothing except champion a woman's right to drive a car. But yesterday, Saudi Arabian activist Lujain Al-Hathloul was released after 1,001 days in prison. Family members and international human rights groups had been calling for her release and an end to her alleged torture. Al-Hathloul was arrested in 2018 for leading a campaign to grant women the right to drive in Saudi Arabia. Dr. Besma Momani joins me now. She's a professor of political science at the University of Waterloo in Canada. Welcome to the program. How significant is this, Lujain Al-Hathloul's release from jail?
Well, it's just wonderful news, to be honest with you. I think so many of us were worried for her. She's a wonderful person, and I think certainly the fact that she's finally been released is a great thing, but there's still a lot of concern about her situation, and I think there's going to be a lot of discussion, and hopefully she'll be able to at some point talk about the suffering she endured.
I mean, the photo of her after release, it's a joyous smile, but how does Lujain even start to rebuild her life after trauma like this? There are allegations of torture during her time in jail.
So I think the rebuilding process for her is going to be significant. Certainly, of course, the trauma of being imprisoned. I think there was abuse that may have been sexual in nature as well. Torture. From looking at the picture, she's clearly thinner. She has gray hair now, and I met her 5 years ago with not a single gray hair on her head. And I mean, there's definitely a beaming smile in the photo, and that's because she's with her parents, but she's still separated from her siblings, of course, many of which are outside the country, and an ex-husband. You know, there was a falling out of a marriage because of this. So I think there's a lot of pain and suffering, I'm sure.
Aside from her parents, do you have a sense of what her support system in Saudi is?
No, I mean, I think she's certainly under some sort of gag order not to speak to people. And I suspect house arrest is a part of that. So she's not going to have free movement in any way. She has a wonderful family, parents who are very supportive and have been really behind her from day one of her activism. They're really quite impressive people.
Dr. Momani, let's get to the bigger picture. We know that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, sees himself as a reformer. What impact could Lujain's release have on the internal politics of Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Mohammed bin Salman really wants to take this as a win. Certainly, I think if it wasn't for the Biden administration, you know, coming in, I don't think we would have seen her release, unfortunately. So, you know, elections matter, as they say. But one of the things that I think, you know, her story will be told, you know, hush, hush. I think many people are discussing it online, and certainly social media is abuzz. There's some very interesting hashtags in Saudi's Twitter to talk about all these kinds of issues. There's still a lot of great discontent. But at the same time, unfortunately, Mohammed bin Salman is seen as a reformer in some way internally. He's opened up the country culturally and certainly, you know, put down the conservative religious police, which is a welcome news for young people. So, you know, I think she would be to be honest with you, more popular outside of Saudi Arabia than inside Saudi Arabia. But that's partly because of kind of the nationalist propaganda that I think has permeated much of Saudi society today.
So you've mentioned a few of the things that have changed in Saudi Arabia while Loujain was imprisoned. You said Mohammed bin Salman wants to take this as a win. Do you think her release is a victory, a real victory for human rights in the kingdom? And could things be changing?
Well, things are changing, without a doubt. You know, one doesn't have to always see, you know, demonstrations in the streets to know that society is changing, and the Saudi society is actually moving quite rapidly. I know it's hard to tell, but it's in every all aspect, whether it's arts, culture, music, you name it. There really is an earthquake of sort of new thinking. But it's also a time where there's more digital authoritarianism. The government is watching people in a way that it never had before. It's silencing people, censoring. And that kind of makes those activists and human rights activists, frankly, more innovative in their way of kind of protesting, if you will, but not protesting, really kind of below that red line. So, I mean, for those who are watching the region, it's fascinating to see how these mostly young people are doing it, but also saddening because once the government kind of gets a whiff of things, they start to clamp down, and the prisons are still full of artists, of intellectuals, journalists, free-thinking people. So it is quite sad.
A lot of people are calling her release a gift or a favor to the Biden administration. How could it lead to greater changes in the Saudi-U.S. relationship over the next 4 years?
This is really an issue to watch, of course, because there's certainly a change in tone. I mean, one can't ignore that the Biden administration has been more tough on Saudi Arabia, pulling their support for the war in Yemen. And I think we're going to see more of this. We can't ignore the fact that Mohammed bin Salman and the entire Saudi regime no longer has one of the greatest friends they've ever had in the White House, that being Donald Trump. So there is going to be, I think, a sea change in the tone and rhetoric. You know, this is still a country that imports the most amount of weapons in the world, and the United States is the greatest exporter of weapons in the world. So I can't help but be a little critical and just wonder how much of this is going to be rhetoric and how much of it's going to be substantive.
Dr. Besma Momani is professor of political science at the University of Waterloo and joined us from Canada. Besma, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If there was a soundtrack for office workers over the past year, it might sound something like this. Yes, triggered in under 3 seconds. Sorry about that. You already have enough screen notifications in your face throughout the day. It is stressful, but a group in South Korea is turning those same sounds into something you'll have to hear to believe. It might even, I don't know, soothe you. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier with that.
Stop rummaging for your phone. It's not ringing. Instead, some a cappella trickery is at play. South Korean group Maytree is going viral online for their spot-on recreations of classic tech sounds. They cover ringtones, buzzers, and alarms. All of this using nothing but their voices. Even more impressive is that the 5-member group also covers less melodic sounds. If you have a Windows computer, you'll recognize this. A USB stick going in and getting taken out. If an error message pops up, you'll hear this sound. The a cappella version is pretty close. Watching the videos of the group making these noises, I can't even tell exactly who is responsible for which sounds. But it all goes together harmoniously, and people have taken notice. On TikTok alone, Maytree has more than 40 million views. As you can probably guess, this crew's talents go way beyond this niche forte. They also tackle more traditional a cappella songs, like this one from British singer Ed Sheeran. But they don't stick to songs with simple strings. They also cover K-pop, a genre known for its flashy, synth-heavy, stylized sound. Here's their cover of Dynamite by South Korean boy band BTS. Compared to the real thing, it's remarkably seamless. Still, the group's pared-down basic sounds from iPhones and Windows computers steal the show. A cappella group Maytree is taking off online and shows no sign of powering down anytime soon. For the world,
I'm Bianca Hillier.
And that's where we power down today. We're always plugged in online, though, at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. Tomorrow is Friday. We'll see you then.